It is time once again for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. Excuse me a second. Okay, that was to get our other guest on the line. Signals and Noise is a discussion segment about things happening on and in the media, and in a world of mass and personalized media, there's always lots to talk about. We do define media very broadly, taking in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from social media to books. Slight change in our guest lineup this month. Chris Lucas is not available, replaced by Andrew Gay of the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University, who actually helped us originate the segment a few years ago. Andrew, you with me?
I think so.
Okay, we got you. And we have Victoria Sama, our regular now, Journalism Chair at Humboldt State University. Victoria, welcome.
Good morning, Jeffrey and Andrew.
Okay,
nice
good. We have you both here. Excellent. So let's begin with one of the major stories in the news at the moment, which is the Derek Chauvin trial. I wrote my notes down as George Floyd trial. I don't want to call it that. It is the trial of Derek Chauvin for killing George Floyd in Minneapolis. Chauvin, a police officer, Floyd, a criminal suspect at the time, and a lot said in recent days about the trauma of having the whole situation relived through the trial coverage, which is not only exhaustive in all media, but also carried online by a newly rejuvenated court TV. Vicky Sama, what do you make of what people are getting from the media about the trial?
We're seeing live hearings from the Derek Chauvin trial. And during those hearings, there's evidence presented. And a lot of that evidence is the viewing of the actual killing of George Floyd with Derek Chauvin's knee kneeling on George Floyd's neck. And those images that we're seeing, some people are seeing them for the first time, some people are seeing them again. You know, I'll admit that when I first became aware of the story, I remember seeing still photos. And for me, this was the first time during this hearing, during this process, that I'm seeing the video. And a young woman who was on the sidewalk witnessing this scene, she was recording it on her cell phone, and that's some of the evidence that's being presented during the hearing. Chauvin's kneeling on George Floyd's neck is very chilling, and it's very real for Black people to feel trauma, especially from watching George Floyd die. It's especially traumatic for a lot of us, all of us, to watch this. It's very sad. But the repetition and the constant reminders, even through witness testimony of the situation, is having an impact on those who are in the audience, watching this historic trial be streamed live and broadcast live. And so I think it behooves us to talk about how we, balance the news value against the potential trauma it's causing for marginalized populations. How can we do that? That woman who was recording that as it was happening and then later posted on social media, which spread worldwide, she's very symbolic in a way, very similar to Emmett Till's mother, who knew that she needed to have the casket of her 14-year-old son, who was brutally murdered by two white men back in 1955. She had the casket open for the public to view, and it was very traumatic, but at the same time, she understood that there are people who are going to deny this history and that it was extremely painful, but that it had to be put out there for everyone to understand that this is the history and this is what is happening. This is the evidence of what is happening. But as media literacy educators and professional journalists, I think we need to reinvent also the Black narrative and show more about Black success and Black happiness. And we need to understand that images like the ones we're seeing in the trial of George Floyd's death perpetuate those, those negative images of Black folks and people of color. So it's important that we try to change the narrative with positive images of Black folks and people of color, and showing some happiness and success rather than just Black misery and death.
We have more to say in just a bit, too. A second item on our list is about media positivity, negativity generally. But before we get to that, I want to ask Andrew Gay for his thoughts and impressions on the opening week or almost a week and a half, almost 2 weeks, in fact, of the Derek Chauvin trial.
I'll be honest, I can't add much to Vicky's eloquent answer there. I was struck by, even in our emails and preparing for this segment, is that we were talking about the ethics of the media's expression of this trial, and I think just speaks to how complex the challenge is, that even in talking about this as a media story, that we are concerned about, you know, how that could be minimizing to the actual impact of the trial itself. So I think it's a really important issue to talk about. I can't remember any other time that CNN has run stories or run a resource list with their stories before. I mean, CNN had, things like the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, Association of Black Psychologists, National Alliance of Mental Illness. They were running these resources saying, hearing testimony about George Floyd's death can be difficult. Here are some resources that may help. And so I think, even the big media companies are very aware of the trauma that this trial is causing. So I think it's always going to be a challenge for us to balance that, the importance to report and to educate, and the importance to be aware of what people can handle.
I find myself thinking of the complaints after the September 11th terrorist attacks about how often the TV networks were showing the planes hitting the buildings, and finally relented and stopped showing it as frequently as they had. But I also realize, Vicky Sama, we're in a different world where you can choose to see things or not much more because of the fragmentation of media and the rise of the internet and the ability to watch video there. And I have to admit, I have not watched the video of George Floyd's death yet, and don't know that I ever will. But these are individual choices that we're in more of a position to make now.
Well, you raise a good point about, that some of the social media now allows for the vast expanse of viewership, and also that it is unvetted, it is raw. We just saw recently during the shootings in the Boulder, Colorado grocery store, the King Super grocery store, there was a person who was in the grocery store live streaming the shooting as it was happening. You can see and hear the gunshots in the background, and he's broadcasting this live on YouTube, and you see a dead body right there in the aisle, and then he walks outside, and there's a person lying on the ground who is presumably dead right at the doorway, and then there's another one in the parking lot. And this is happening live and real. It's unfettered. It's unedited. It's there's no, journalistic principles or any kinds of editorial decision making happening. Those are things that are happening live, and they, this goes back. We can talk about, how this, when we were first starting to see this type of thing, we could go back to the Rodney King beating, and how there was a citizen, who just an ordinary person just recording what was happening, and how that was broadcast immediately live out to the masses. And so, there's a news value to this, but there's also that trauma that has to be considered. And I want to mention that there is a place that journalists and also ordinary citizens can look to. It's the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma. And they really talk about, this, especially in this day and age, how journalists seem to be exposed by reporting these stories over and over again. I mean, it's been a really tough, challenging year, full of trauma from COVID-19 and, reporting on the deaths. And I have friends who are still working as journalists who've been working on this story for the past year and exposed to that, and the Black Lives Matter protests and people being beaten and this trial and all these different very traumatic stories. And then, of course, there's journalists who are in Myanmar right now, and they're experiencing all this trauma. And the DART Center has a list of some suggestions on how journalists can work through it, how people can work through it. And one of those tips is definitely to take time out, to take time away, to make editors aware when you're feeling these kinds of feelings of anxiety and drain and exhaustion. It's important to talk about it and to confide in friends and family and find those communities where you can have those kinds of conversations and with people who are understanding about it, because not everybody is going to feel that same way. But there are people of color right now who have, you know, these similar lived experiences. George Floyd represents to them that that could be them. That could be their daughter, their son, their brother, their uncle, their father. And so it's very real, and the trauma is very real, and it's important to discuss and acknowledge.
Signals and Noise here on the Jefferson Exchange with Vicki Sahma from Humboldt State University and Andrew Gay from Southern Oregon University. If you have a contribution to make by email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Let's move on to a more general range of things here, Andrew, and talk about the idea that the U.S. News has a bias toward negativity, particularly where COVID-19 comes in.
Right, yeah. So the New York Times had reported on this data that, when comparing the way that other nations and even within the U.S. media, regional media covers the coronavirus, comparing that to the large media companies, and I believe that included both sort of liberal-leaning outlets like MSNBC to conservative-leaning outlets like Fox News and the New York Times itself, they found that the big U.S. media companies really, no matter what was happening in the news, accentuated the negative facts. So it wasn't that they were making up facts necessarily, but that they were accentuating that negative information around the coronavirus. And one of the questions here is, is this just a COVID situation, or is this something that is happening across all news stories? Is the U.S. media tending to tell us what's bad that's going on? And what is the role of the news media? I mean, obviously, we want to expose, things that are going on in the world, that educate the audience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, at what point are we giving people an overly negative view of the world? I think it goes kind of back to what Vicki was talking about, the Black community, needing to tell other kinds of stories, particularly about that community. And I think that's true in our media diet in general, that, I know many people who have now turned off the news. They can't watch it anymore because it's just so much, right? And our lives have become so strained under the past year that they aren't finding anything that is useful for them. And I think, I was actually reminded, I was just talking to Richard Herskowitz, the artistic director of the Ashland Independent Film Festival, and he was talking about programming documentaries, and he was mentioning that he really liked to program activist films because they exposed issues that were problems, but rather than focusing on the problem and getting everyone depressed about, oh gosh, there's another problem, focus on people who are doing something about that problem and how that was uplifting and inspiring and gave a model for people to follow. And I thought that was a great comment about, just how to program a film festival. But I think that could also be something that we could see more of in our news. When we're talking about these challenges in society, let's not just talk about the challenges. Let's talk about the people who are doing things to solve them.
All right. Your thoughts, Vicki?
Yeah, I want to discuss and bring in on this that the study itself, I kind of looked into it to see how they measured negative news on COVID, and it was sort of an analysis of the opinions of the people and the stories. It's really hard to do a story about COVID and people dying for the last year in a pandemic, a worldwide pandemic that's been pretty detrimental to economies and to lives, and have it not, have it be positive. So sort of the topic itself, it kind of lends itself to that. But I also want to bring in a solution to that problem. There is something called the Solutions Journalism Network, and they are doing a pretty good job on trying to refocus journalists in their work on the solutions to problems rather than just social, problems and or climate problems that we seem to see the focus and emphasis on in the mainstream press.
Okay. I did want to point out, too, Andrew, I looked at the stuff that Bruce Sasserdote, the economics professor at Dartmouth College, put out, and the day the New York Times reported on it on March 24th, new cases of COVID in the country did go above 60,000 that day and have remained there for all but 2 days since. Upswing is real. The question is which numbers you choose to tell your story. in a lot of cases. Let's pick up a lighter topic here and talk about, Andrew, since you're the guy who teaches digital cinema, let's talk about theaters coming back and what's going on there.
Yeah, we're excited about some of the indicators. This is obviously a disaster of a year for the film industry and especially movie theaters. And there's been a lot of questioning. You know, theaters have struggled for a while, and there's a lot of talk about whether would COVID be the final nail in the coffin? Is a theatrical experience just going to go away entirely? Will any of these companies survive? I mean, just locally here in Ashland, Coming Attractions Theaters, which is based in Ashland, closed one of their Ashland theaters, the Ashland Street Cinema, which was particularly popular among college students to go over there and watch the latest movies. And that really has an impact on the community. When a theater closes, it's a gathering place, a place that people go and have a night away from the kids and all those things. But we have some good news, and that's that Godzilla vs. Kong came out and was the first big opening weekend where the film actually did better than its predecessor. The Godzilla King of the Monsters made a little bit more money than that one did in its opening weekend. And so a lot of the analysts are beginning to say, well, maybe theaters are going to make it. Maybe we'll still have a theatrical experience, and we'll make it through this pandemic slump.
It's been interesting to watch that, particularly with Godzilla versus Kong. And one of the reviews I read said, well, you could try to look for a deeper meaning here, but mostly it's just a fight.
Yeah. I think people who went out to see that were doing exactly what it was designed to do, which is escape, right? It's an escapist film to watch, and I think that's why people like to go to movie theaters, is to escape.
Vicky, heavy time, light stuff, is that what we need?
Yeah, I think so. It's an interesting marker to see that if things are getting back to normal, that movie theaters reopen. I know that the movie houses have been offering alternatives, obviously, on Netflix and Disney Plus, and so people have been able to pay per view or watch these productions. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens this summer. The movie production houses haven't been putting out that much content, obviously, during COVID. So, there can only be so many movies that are going to come to actual movie theaters, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out this summer, which they're hoping for big box office hits because they need to make up for the big loss they suffered last year.
Nice. And that, one of the interesting things there is that, Godzilla vs. Kong was a dual release. They released it both on HBO Now and, HBO Max is the new name, and in theaters, and it still did better than its predecessor. There's some debate about whether HBO Max or whether Warner made a mistake. And if they should have held it only in a theatrical window, because that's one of the bigger discussions right now in the industry, is what will the window be, meaning the time between the release in theaters and the release at home. There's been a lot of debate about how small that window will become and how many films will be released both at home and in theaters at the same day, or how many will be still reserved first for that theatrical experience, and then at home. Disney with Raya and the Last Dragon, they released simultaneously in theaters and at home, but they charged their users a premium price. So they're still charging some extra money in order to see it at home, whereas Godzilla vs. Kong came with the subscription.
Interesting stuff. Okay, before we move into pick threes, I want to point out, Vicky, I've been taking notes on what you were talking about. So I do have, we'll put links up for dartcenter.org for the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma and the Solutions Journalism Center at solutionsjournalism.org. We'll put those up at the blurb for this item here on the Exchange website. And now we have, you get a minute plus each for pick threes. Vicky?
Oh boy, this is tough for me because I'm in the heart of my semester, so I'm not getting to do much outside of schoolwork these days, and I can't wait till May. But right now I'm trying to read the book. It's not new. It's All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dower, and I was given that by a friend, and I'm just in the beginning of the book and enjoying that very much. But I am looking forward to possibly watching some of the new movies, and especially always after the Oscar awards are delivered later this month, I'll be trying to tap into some of those nominations, including a few of them, like Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, seems to be a
excellent film.
A favorite. It's on the Screen Actors Guild Awards, so I'll be looking for that in the future.
Okay. Andrew, what's your pick three for the
month? Ashland Independent Film Festival is coming up, and I am a programmer with the festival, and so I wanted to give a shout-out to three of my recommendations. First is the two locals programs, which feature local filmmakers from Southern Oregon and Northern California, and I'm very proud to have three films directed by my students in that in those programs. My second recommendation are the two regular shorts programs, which I helped program. Among those are two shorts that I absolutely loved, among the best shorts I've ever seen, one called Guide On and one called Dai Yi. And then finally, a feature film, Summertime, directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada, actually the same director who directed Raya and the Last Dragon, although this is not an animated film. It's a live-action poetry musical. It's really interesting, very celebratory and fun, and a good time.
Okay, so, all right, so lots of stuff coming at the Ashland Independent Film Festival. We do have Richard Herskowitz coming back next week to talk about one of the particular features that'll be starting off the whole shebang, which is April 15th through 29th for the first tranche, is that right?
Yep, that's right.
Okay, and I just want to point out, too, as we were talking about streaming services, I just read a day or two ago that it's gotten to the point where if you get all the streaming services together, you're going to be spending about as much as you would on cable. So,
yeah.
So much for cord cutting.
Exactly.
We can take that up in the future. Andrew Gay subbing for Chris Lucas this month. Good to have you back on Signals and Noise. And Victoria Sama, always a pleasure to have you, the journalism chair from Humboldt State University.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks.
All right.